Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. No more hola. Northern Hemisphere.
I'm in America.
You are. You are in America.
Which means I could really use just about any language we wanted, but yeah.
The great melting pot of the world. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. This season, as Lara eats her way around Mexico, or formerly ate her way around Mexico, the two of us are coming together via the wonders of the internet to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs, and we'll be discussing whether reading can make you happier and why you procrastinate. But first things first, Lara, what's the best thing you've eaten this week?
Well, as I said, I am in the US at the moment and I'm in New York, so there's a plethora of delicious things to eat. And I'm putting the tacos aside for a moment. And I went out for brunch the other day for my friend's birthday to the Commodore in Williamsburg, where they do an absolutely banging fried chicken biscuit. And I love American biscuits, even though, Jeremy, like they're just scones, right?
It's scone.
Like it's a scone. Yeah. The whole thing is like doused in some sort of like buttery maple chili concoction, and it's heaven.
Fantastic. And how long are you over there for?
I'm in New York for 10 days and then back to Mexico City for like a week, and then I come home.
Oh my God. The time has gone so quick. It's too wild.
Quick. But I know.
I'm looking forward to hearing more about everything, and I think we'll just get stuck straight into things with my link of the week. And this is titled, Can Reading Make You Happier?
Yes.
It's a piece from New York.
Yes. Done. Next topic.
Good. For anyone who's a longtime listener of the show or reads my newsletter intros, so basically my parents, basically only.
Probably my parents too.
And your parents. I'm on a really big self-improvement quest at the moment. Let's just say that my Kindle is probably the biggest window into my soul right now. And I was talking to someone about this the other day, how like, I don't like, you know, talking about privacy, I don't care if anyone reads my emails, my text, like anything. But if anyone peeked into my Kindle bookshelf, it is a cornucopia of just craziness. I mean, there is great lit fiction there as well. But like, I just kind of feel, you know, especially with books, there was always kind of like with the self-help stuff, I think the physical book was always kind of like, do I want people to see me reading this, you know, or do I want this kind of on my bookshelf? Because I'm not going to throw it away. But like now with the Kindle, that's kind of completely unbridled. Like I can just do anything, especially with one click shopping.
Is it just it like chicken amazing. Soup for the soul and 50 Shades of Grey?
Yes. Yes. So look, in that spirit, this link went straight into the podcast airtable as soon as it popped up. And again, it's titled, Can Reading Make You Happier? It's a fantastic and pretty breezy story from the latest issue of The New Yorker. Usually when I click on a New Yorker link, I prepare like, you know, for at least a 30 to 40 minute read, but this is pretty quick. So written by Sarah Dwyn Dovey, she posits that, I'm quoting here, for all avid readers who have been self-medicating with great books their entire lives, it comes as no surprise that reading books can be good for you. And this has definitely been my own experience over the last year. And while I've always been an avid reader, like my whole life, I think, you know, that kind of stopped for a bit. And I've really made some very deliberate experiences or deliberate choices recently to make reading a non-negotiable part of my daily routine. And to that end, I was really shocked to learn that there are actual people who exist who work as bibliotherapists. And literally one of my open tabs is a Melbourne-based bibliotherapist. I'm calling one of them ASAP after reading this. And this was really the thrust of the story. And I was just really gobsmacked by the obviousness and amazingness of this whole idea. I mean, of course, just look at the whole self-help publishing industry. Obviously, people use books to improve their lives. But what bibliotherapists actually do is prescribe fiction. So firstly, to define things, I'm quoting here, bibliotherapy is a very broad term for the ancient practice of encouraging reading for therapeutic effect. The first use of the term actually dated to a jaunty 1916 article in the Atlantic Monthly titled A Literary Clinic. Now, the piece centers around the work of bibliotherapists Ella Berthoud and Susan Elderkin, who met in college and as friends prescribed each other books for many years. And eventually, when Alain de Botton, a fellow Cambridge classmate, was thinking about starting the School of Life, they pitched in the idea of running a bibliotherapy clinic. And together, and I quote here, we're dedicated to fiction as the ultimate cure because it gives readers a transformational experience. And there from the article goes on to talks about the different books they kind of prescribe for different people based on their circumstances. You know, what are the mechanisms that actually kind of make this work? And Dovey writes that reading fiction makes me lose all sense of self, but at the same time makes me feel uniquely myself. And she points out Virginia Woolf, the most fervent of readers, wrote that a book splits us into two parts as we read. For the state of reading consists in the complete elimination of the ego while promising perpetual union with another mind. And a lot of these things are very kind of similar and have overlaps to things like mindfulness and meditation, which I mean, it makes completely obvious why the two benefits, you know, really kind of overlap and kind of work on these kind of same mechanisms. On a more scientific level, she writes that, I'm quoting here again, since the discovery in the mid-90s of mirror neurons, neurons that fire in our brains both when we perform an action ourselves and when we see an action performed by someone else, the neuroscience of empathy has become clearer. A 2011 study published in the Annual Review of Psychology based on analysis of fMRI brain scans of participants showed that when people read about an experience, they display stimulation with the same neurological regions as when they go through that experience themselves. We draw on the same brain networks when we're reading stories and when we're trying to guess at another person's feelings. So even if you don't agree that reading fiction makes us treat others better, it's definitely a way of treating ourselves better. Again, this has been my own personal experience. And even before reading this piece or familiarizing myself with the concept, I've actually really re-engaged with my love of fiction and found that in addition to my own mindfulness practice, that act of reading offers such a strong antidote to wandering attention that it's basically like giving my brain a little toy to play with, which allows it to kind of settle down in the background and really help with my overall mood, sleep, other things that I've really kind of struggled with lately. So I love it when a piece like this confirms my overall experience, but also kind of adds a new layer to it. And in addition to all the good stuff above, I actually found that makes me a better writer and communicator. I've been thinking a lot about the intersection of writing and creative work and specifically production. And I kind of feel that, you know, one thing I was kind of talking about, like, you know, that writing is really kind of a skill that kind of comes from a lot of early reading as well. And so, yeah, I find that, especially for me, who is very suggestible, I pick up these kind of different tics and kind of habits of the writers that I'm kind of reading at the moment. And so interesting to see how it kind of, I guess, finds its way into my work. So obviously, like any other kind of quote unquote cure, there are drawbacks as well. So like if you're constantly using reading as a way to distract yourself, it's probably not the intended use. I still think the idea of being quiet in a room by yourself, i.e. meditation, is an essential counterbalance for this. So I think it's still an activity that needs to be done mindfully. Also, the types of books that you read, I think, are really important as well, especially when you think about how it actually works physiologically. So yeah, it's like,
I read some really depressing books.
Oh, that, of course. And or things like kind of like, and I love kind of thrillers and other things as well. But like even like with true crime podcasts, like I had to stop listening to them because I was just getting such vivid nightmares. So I think it's really interesting to just, I don't know, again, this is me just kind of getting older, but kind of really thinking about, yeah, like it is kind of like medicine in that way. Like you can't just kind of put things into your brain left and right without an appreciation of what it's going to do for you. And while it can have, you know, positive effects, there are the potential negative ones as well. At the risk of overquoting this article, I really found the closing paragraph here quite strong, as I'm at the point now where I'm really kind of thinking carefully, you know, about these things, about what I kind of put into my brain. Talking about the book written by these two bibliotherapists called The Novel Cure, one of the ailments that they list is, and I'm quoting here, being overwhelmed by the number of books in the world, and it's one I suffer from frequently. Elderkin says that this is one of the most common woes of modern readers and that it remains a major motivation for her and Berthoud's work as bibliotherapists. We feel that though more books are being published than ever before, people are in fact selecting from a smaller and smaller pool. Look at the reading list of most book clubs and you'll see all the same books, the ones that have been shouted about in the press. If you actually calculate how many books you read in a year and how many that means you're likely to read before you die, you'll start to realize that you need to be highly selective in order to make the most of your reading time. And the best way to do that, see a bibliotherapist as soon as you can and take them up on their invitation to borrow some lines from Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus. Come and take choice of all my library and so beguile thy sorrow. And man, I'm just thinking right now, we're going to need people to tell us what to watch on Netflix as well soon, because the amount of content out there is severe.
We need to stop worrying so much about the fact whether what we read or watch or listen to is good and just, you know, crate dig again.
Well, Lara, yes, I do want to hear more of your thoughts on here. I mean, you've often speak about your own passion for reading here in many different contexts, and we're always talking about books here in different ways. So look, I'm sure none of this is news to you. I'm curious to hear more about your thoughts. Would you ever see a bibliotherapist? Or if you were a bibliotherapist yourself, what would you prescribe to me? I'm very curious.
Jeremy, for you, I would just prescribe a brown cardigan. Just stay on the blog. You'll be fine. It'll help you.
Thank you. Basically the equivalent of gummy vitamins. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I would love to see a bibliotherapist if it wasn't just as expensive as seeing a regular therapist. Seriously, did you check out some of the prices? Because I did the same thing. I started Googling it as well. I was really curious to see how sort of widespread this was. I mean, look, maybe it's covered by, when it's covered by Medicare, I'll go. But yeah, I've always loved reading because it's an activity you can do when you're broke and it's mega accessible. We're ignoring the issue of literacy here, but that's another conversation altogether. But aside from the price point, I love this concept. And I wholeheartedly agree that reading fiction can be incredibly transformative and educational, sometimes even more so than nonfiction in many, many ways. And I can think of so many books in my life that have, you know, actually adjusted, whether actively or more passively, adjusted the way that I think and feel and act. And I don't know how long lasting these effects are, but that is exactly why it's so wonderful to reread books at different points in your life and see how they affect you differently at each stage. I have a few books that I've read many times at different ages and I get something completely different at each time. I don't know if you have the same thing, Jeremy, but
well, books, yeah, they stay with you. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. But that you reread again, like as you get older, and it's like, it's interesting to see how as you've experienced new things and your sort of realm of reference has shifted and expanded, the kind of different things you can glean from the same book. It's, I don't know, to me, it's something really special about reading. And Jeremy, I agree with you that this article doesn't come as a surprise, but it's really lovely to see people taking advantage of the kind of cathartic and transformative powers of reading and using it to help shape the lives of others. To go back, there's that paragraph you read from earlier, the one in which they note that reading fiction makes you kind of lose all sense of self, yet at the same time feel most uniquely yourself, and that the state of reading involves both the complete elimination of the ego while promising perpetual union with another mind. And those lines just lit up light bulbs for me. And I reread them several times because I thought that's just so accurate. Reading is at once this like incredibly solitary, but deeply connecting experience. And you're kind of in this safe space inside your head with no kind of real world consequences. And so you're enabled to explore thoughts and feelings as kind of prompted by someone else's perspective, be that, you know, the author or the characters through the author. And therefore, connecting intimately with their story and their timeline and their worldview. And reading is kind of like taking this crash course in empathy, reading fiction anyway. And that's something they touch on in this article, that studies show that reading enhances one's ability to empathize and to recognize emotional cues in others. And obviously, enhanced empathetic skills are useful in almost every facet of life and work. And I really struggle to think of a profession that wouldn't be enhanced by increased empathy, except maybe like an executioner, but I don't know that there's many of those anymore. Jeremy, you mentioned you find reading makes you a better writer and communicator, and I definitely agree. We've talked about that before on the show, and I think it's not only because reading great writing exposes you to broader vocabulary and sentence structures. As you said, you kind of pick up these good habits. You could pick up bad ones as well, and it can teach you, of course, about pacing and clarity and narrative techniques, et cetera, et cetera. But also because of this whole empathy thing, right? Because communication in any form is entirely about empathy. It's about understanding the receiver and how they'll take in your message. And reading helps you improve both those sort of hard and soft skills. And ideally, in many cases, you don't even notice it because you're just sort of enjoying yourself. It doesn't feel like studying, you know, in the way that other learning can. And I think for me, I find that reading not only helps me be better at writing, but it also actually motivates me to write more. You know, the more I surround myself with great literature, and by that I mean everything from like internet essays to Penguin Classics to comic books, the more motivated and excited I feel to write my own things, even work things. You know, it's a nice bonus, I think, of reading. I guess before I wrapped up, I wanted to point out a paragraph in the article that I found super interesting. And I don't know if this stood out to you as well, Jeremy, but you mentioned that, yeah, Berthoud and Eldekin authored this book called The Novel Cure, An A to Z of Literary Remedies, which is like written in the style of a kind of medical dictionary. And they match ailments, for example, feeling like a failure, with suggested reading cures. For example, The History of Mr. Polly by H.G. Wells, which, oh, awesome idea. I would love to get my hands on this book. But what was super interesting to me was the fact that since its original release in the UK in 2013, the book's been published in 18 countries, and the licensing contract includes a clause that allows a local editor and reading specialist to adapt up to 25% of the ailments and reading recommendations to fit each particular country's readership, and also to include more native writers, which is just such a cool idea. And of course, some of the adapted ailments are quite kind of culturally revealing, which is super fascinating. For example, in the Dutch edition, one of the additional ailments is having too high an opinion of your own child. In the Indian edition, public urination and obsession with cricket were added. The Italians introduced impotence, fear of motorways, and desire to embalm, which that one threw me. And the Germans added hating the world and hating parties, which I thought was hilarious. And I don't know if there is one, but I don't think there is an Australian edition, but I was wondering like, what would that include? Like, I mean, you probably have things like tall poppy syndrome, which is always talked about as being very Australian. Maybe you could even have just like sunburn or something. But yeah, look, I mean, this article, it's pretty old. It's from 2015. And I'd love to know whether the practice of bibliotherapy has picked up more since then, even just from the kind of brief Googling I did. And then I got scared by the prices. It seems like it is not huge, but it's a thing, right? Are there people doing it other than the School of Life, or is it sort of still just through there in Australia?
Well, the person that I am going to be talking to in Australia, it seems to—
Oh my God, you've booked an appointment.
I'm very serious about this. Yes, I'm absolutely going to be booking
it. I'm super into it as well. I love the idea. Back, yeah. I can't wait to hear about it.
I will come back and report back.
I think it's a really great idea. And I think like in order to be a bibliotherapist, to do it well, you'd have to be a supremely talented, empathetic person. Not only do you need to be able to kind of be very skilled in understanding and assessing someone's troubles, you then need to be diversely well-read enough to be able to figure out what to prescribe and to prescribe for people of all types, because it's hard recommending books for people because you like what you like, and it's hard to understand why someone might like something sometimes.
Yeah, I'm so interested in how, like, I've been, yeah, like, you know, in someone who can actually kind of take my kind of personal recommendations and kind of give me something. And when there's nothing I love more than recommending something to somebody and having them love it. Like, that is such a great feeling.
Oh, me too, completely. But it's not just about recommending a good book or a book that you enjoyed. It's about figuring out, who is this person inside? What do they need help with? What kind of guidance are they needing? And what kind of book can sort of subtly give that to them? I think it would be really difficult, but it's amazing that people are able to do it. And also, Jeremy, it's like my birthday in 2 weeks. So if anyone, you, wants to buy me a session with a bibliotherapist, it will be received with open arms. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your comments as well. And we'll move on to our next link from there. For our second link of the week, Lara, you're going to tell us all about procrastination in this new piece from The Times. Take it away.
Oh, Jeremy, yes, the irony was not lost on me that I fluffed around with about a million other things before I read this article. It was open in my tabs for ages, and I was like, I don't want to read it. But yes, as you said, it's a piece from the New York Times. It's titled, Why You Procrastinate. It has nothing to do with self-control. And it appealed to me because while I can be very, very focused and I'm very hardworking, there are definitely certain tasks, I think, like for most people, that send my procrastination into overdrive. And I've always felt like when that happens, that it just means I just don't have very good willpower. And, you know, that's why I'm not able to stay on track. And this article presents a bit of a different angle. And I know this is a problem for most people, especially freelancers who lack some of the structure that can normally kind of help to combat this. And according to this article, procrastination isn't to do with laziness, because sometimes the things we do to procrastinate are anything but lazy. The example they give is like, alphabetizing the spice drawer, which I'm sure I've done something similar at some point. But basically, it's this kind of irrational form of self-harm, which is a very strong word, but they sort of favor this in the article. And to quote, they say, self-awareness is a key part of why procrastinating makes us feel so rotten. When we procrastinate, we're not only aware that we're avoiding the task in question, but also that doing so is probably a bad idea. And yet we do it anyway. People engage in this irrational cycle of chronic procrastination because of an inability to manage negative moods around a task. So what does that mean? Basically, the article suggests that procrastination is this way of coping with challenging emotions and negative moods that are kind of induced by these certain tasks. So whether that's boredom or anxiety or frustration, insecurity, resentment, self-doubt, any other multitude of wonderful feelings that we've all felt at some point. And they quote in the piece this guy, Dr. Tim Peichel, who I kept reading as Pikelet. It's not Pikelet, it's Peichel. Dr. Tim Peichel, who says, procrastination is an emotion regulation problem, not a time management problem, which is quite different to how we sort of normally hear about it. His studies have shown that procrastination is really more about being focused on the immediate urgency of managing negative moods more so than getting on with the task. And that sort of will outweigh the importance of the task. And the particular nature of our aversion obviously depends on the given task or situation. It might be due to something inherently unpleasant about the task itself. So maybe you have to like clean a dirty bathroom, or you've got to deal with a really long, boring, horrible spreadsheet. But it also can come from deeper feelings related to the task. So that's when we get into things like self-doubt, low self-esteem, anxiety, insecurity. The example they give here, to quote again, staring at a blank document, you might be thinking, I'm not smart enough to write this. Even if I am, what will people think of it? Writing is so hard. What if I do a bad job? All of this can lead us to think that putting the document aside and cleaning that spice drawer instead is a pretty good idea. But yeah, of course, all of this only just compounds the negative associations we have with the task. And those feelings are still going to be there whenever we actually come back to do it, along with the increased stress and anxiety, feelings of low self-esteem, self-blame, and, you know, having way less time to actually do the thing we're meant to do in the first place. So yay, lots of good stuff. And there's actually this kind of entire body of research they note to in the piece that's dedicated to these kind of ruminative self-blaming thoughts that many of us will have in the wake of procrastination, which are, they're known as procrastinatory cognitions. And basically these thoughts typically kind of exacerbate out of stress and our stress, which then contribute to further procrastination. So it's this really fun cycle that I'm sure will be familiar to a lot of people. And that momentary relief that we feel when procrastinating is actually kind of what makes the cycle especially vicious, where mammals' classic conditioning works on us. In the immediate present, putting off a task provides relief, and you've essentially then been rewarded for procrastinating. And we know from basic behaviorism that when we're rewarded for something, we tend to do it again. And so procrastination tends to be not so much a one-off behavior, but a bit of a cycle, and one that can really easily become a chronic habit. And according to the scientists, we have evolution to thank for this, because we've got this kind of hardwired tendency to prioritize short-term needs ahead of long-term ones. And we see our future selves as separate people, strangers, you know, rather than parts of ourselves. And so when we procrastinate, and I can totally relate to this, part of our brains, even though we rationally know it's not true, part of our brains thinks that the tasks that we're putting off are now kind of somebody else's problem. Future you is not you. It's not current you. And so it's somebody else's problem, even though it really truly is you, and it'll be worse down the track. Look, the article does try to offer up some solutions to get at the root cause of procrastination and kind of break out of this cycle. But I don't know, nothing in here particularly wowed me. What I do agree with, though, is acknowledging that procrastination at its core is about emotions and not about productivity. So it's not necessarily something that can be solved by downloading the Pomodoro app. To quote from the piece, our brains are always looking for relative rewards. If we have a habit loop around procrastination, but we haven't found a better reward, our brain is just going to keep doing it over and over until we give it something better to do, says psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Judson Brewer. To rewire any habit, we have to give our brains what Dr. Brewer calls the bigger, better offer, or BBO. And I don't know why they shorten it, because they never mention it again in the article. In the case of procrastination, we have to find a better reward than avoidance, one that can relieve our challenging feelings in the present moment without causing harm to our future selves. The difficulty with breaking the addiction to procrastination in particular is that there is an infinite number of potential substitute actions that would still be forms of procrastination. That's why the solution, therefore, must be internal and not dependent on anything but ourselves. And look, to be quite honest with you, I have no idea how to put that into practice. The article kind of talks about forgiving yourself, practicing self-compassion. And I mean, those are great things, of course, but I don't know if how does that really help in this situation? That's where the article left me kind of blank. And Jeremy, I want to turn over to you. I mean, look, are you a procrastinator? Do you have this problem?
No, because I'm a delegator.
What? Have you always been like that?
Well, in a way, I mean, I think, you know, look, I agree with everything that is posited here. And like, yeah, obviously, I kind of thinking about procrastination as an emotional issue is definitely how I've always kind of framed it. But I kind of feel, I kind of ascribe to the Bill Gates kind of theory, when he kind of talks about hiring kind of the laziest people, because usually really lazy people are really inventive in terms of kind of how to figure things out, basically, like, you know, figure out the easiest kind of way to do something. And so I've always kind of really kind of leaned into that. I mean, I've never been someone who I think because of, I guess.
But if you're procrastinating, you're not going to tackle it at all. That's the problem.
Yeah, but
it's not about being lazy. It's not about finding the easiest way to do it. It's about not wanting to deal with it, you know?
Yeah, but I think that, like, there's a lot of procrastination that there, I guess if you look at the neurosis scale from anxiety to depression, I think, you know, the fact I'm very kind of motivated by anxiety. Like, I don't really kind of have or experience kind of a lot of regret or kind of feeling down about things kind of in general, but I definitely am in touch with a lot of anxiety and those kind of more excitable things, which I think more kind of inspire kind of action in that way. So
So you're on uppers, not downers.
Yeah, basically. But, you know, it's not to say that, like, when a task doesn't get done, I wouldn't kind of feel bad about it. It's just that, like, I would just kind of find a way, you know, I'd either kind of find a way to make it happen or just kind of reframe.
You asked me to do it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of, that's an interesting thing if you think about what being a manager is like, and think about those kind of two people of kind of present you and kind of future, you know, me. I kind of see, like, you know, I look at all kind of my staff in some ways as kind of expressions of future me, kind of in that way. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think it's kind of, no, I think if you're, good, if you're a good manager, like, you know, and the business is kind of a reflection of you in kind of some ways, and, you know, then that could be an interesting kind of way to look at things there. But yeah.
Like, the tricky thing is when you're not in that position, and then you have tasks that you absolutely, you will have to do. You can't delegate. You can't get someone else to do it. And how do you kind of learn to break that sort of, what can be a really bad cycle? Because I know that feeling where you know you should be doing something. You're doing something. For me, it's cleaning. Like I just can't stand cleaning. I hate it. I hate doing it. And I, like, you know this, my desk is a nightmare. And I will do almost anything else to avoid doing it, you know? And it's just that thing. And then when I do it, it's fine. It's not that bad. But it's like still breaking that kind of that mental attachment to the idea that it's going to be the worst. It's going to take me hours. It's going to, you know, is really, really difficult. And I'm sure that maybe you don't relate, but I'm sure someone else who listens to this podcast will, and maybe they will have some ideas that can help me.
Well, look, it's something I'm going through kind of right now. Like, you know, we're working on a very kind of big project at the moment that, like, requires me to actually kind of sit down and do the work. And that is such a different kind of mind shift for me from kind of coming into work and then having to just kind of deal with lots of kind of different things. And, like, I have found that to be incredibly, it's kind of literally has felt like running into a brick wall. Like, you know, my days are kind of have all this momentum and then I have to stop and actually kind of focus on something. And I think, yeah, like shifting that mind state makes me realize, oh my God, like, my attention is still, like, you know, even with all my mindfulness, all my other kind of work, it's still like a fucking nightmare up there, you know? And I get in really dark moods when I have to sit and focus on something for more than kind of 5 minutes. And
I am aware. I have
you have seen this.
I think that one thing I would say before we, like, wrap up is that the thing that does help me, and everyone has things that are, you know, different for them, but the thing that's helped me, because now I tend to procrastinate with stuff that's in it's my own life tasks. With work, I'm pretty good, right? And lucky for you.
Lol.
but I think what helped me definitely, and it really depends on the kind of workplace you're in, but the thing that helps me is knowing what kind of times a day, or understanding my moods, understanding my energy levels, and knowing what times a day I am going to be able to tackle those things that I really don't really want to deal with, and what times a day it's just not going to happen, you know, and working with that rather than trying to always swim upstream. And I know a lot of people sort of talk about that, and it can be hard to do. But for example, if you're a night owl, you're a morning person, whatever, some people, it's like first thing in the morning, they have to tackle the hardest thing. Other people, like, I'm someone who kind of prefers to work up to it. And then at the end of the day, I'm like ready to go. It's like, well, I'm working all day, but the hardest, most annoying thing, I rather do at night. I don't know why. It's just the way my brain works. And learning to understand those things can be really, really helpful.
Absolutely. And I kind of think, you know, the one kind of thing I'd kind of close on this is, I think for me, I just think, like, it seems, again, so kind of obvious, but we have such bad short-term memories. And sometimes with work stuff, it's kind of like similar to kind of going to the gym. And even though kind of I love going to the gym and I love how I feel afterwards, like, making that first step to do it is so hard sometimes.
God, yeah.
And I think working on a big project, it's all those kind of small steps. And then you get to the end and then it's like, okay, you know, and then, like, then that's it. Like, you know, it's hard to kind of actually, you know, rejoice in kind of the thing that you do and kind of how you kind of feel about it. So I think it's really important to get into, it's like you have to kind of overlay or kind of overwrite those kind of feelings in your head that the kind of the first small step is the most, is really kind of painful, because it is, but really try to focus that on what you're kind of going to get out of that. And I think it's like, when you do experience those times where you complete a task, to kind of really just kind of relish in that a bit more. And I think, you know, try to get in touch more with kind of those feelings and those kind of memories. And then it can become something that you hold on to that gets you to that first thing better. Cause you know that even if it sucks at the moment, there's going to be something waiting on the other side. And I think, yeah, that's going to be
good
true
advice, Jeremy.
In artwork production, in every kind of thing that we can do as creatives and producers. So, as always, you know, a very relatable link there. Thank you very much, Lara.
You're welcome.
Before we wrap up for the week, we're going through some of our other open tabs, the other things that have been in our browser that we haven't really quite had a chance to kind of talk about or haven't found room for here, like our IRL open tabs events, where we get kind of four speakers to go through 10 of their browser tabs over 10 minutes. Here's some that didn't make the cut for us this week. So the first one for me is a new book that's been written by the team at Basecamp. And this is amazing. It's called Shape Up, Stop Running in Circles and Ship Work That Matters. And so this is, you know, Basecamp is typically kind of really known for kind of their writing about work, about kind of, you know, about their own culture. And they've, you know, written lots of really best-selling books, but this new book is kind of just free. It's out there. What we talk about here on the podcast so often is, you know, trying to take things from other industries. And so even though this is really about kind of software development in so many ways, it's really kind of about much more than that. So yeah, if you're into kind of what we talk about, and which is really been informed a lot by the team at Basecamp, I definitely think this is worth a read. And it's a very kind of long form read. It's a full on book. The second link that I have is a new campaign called Fair Share for Artists. It's fairshareforartists.org. And this is, you know, kind of really very similar to kind of what we were trying to do with Use It or Lose It as well. It's a campaign, you know, that has been launched in the UK. And it's basically just kind of showing your support for kind of artists and talking about like how it comes from an organization called DACS, D-A-C-S. I don't know the actual acronym at the moment, but they're kind of like the copyright organization in Australia in terms of trying to make sure that fees go back to artists upon resale of the work as well. And we've kind of talked about this.
I bet the C stands for copyright.
No, I don't think it does. But anyway, it's an interesting campaign. If you're interested in kind of what we're doing for Use It or Lose It and kind of want to see a bit of a twist on that, definitely kind of check that out. And the final thing that I just kind of thought was really interesting was a piece from the Twitter marketing blog where they're introducing Twitter Art House, which is kind of their in-house kind of creative agency. And I'm always really interested to see whenever these, you know, mega companies launch these kind of things. You know, Tumblr did one. They have their kind of creators. Facebook has kind of this curated by Facebook thing. And now kind of Twitter is kind of putting their hand in the fray. So yeah, some really interesting movements to kind of keep an eye on if you're interested in kind of where creativity is commissioned from and kind of how it finds its way into our culture. Yeah, some things to check out. Lara, what is on your open tabs?
Oh, well, look, I don't know how relevant these are going to be to other people, but I'm going to go with it anyway. The first thing I've had in my open tabs is, I swear this is not a sponsored thing, though if they would like to sponsor us, if anyone would, that would be great. Thank you. New Mobile, have you heard of this? I've been trying to figure out how to get a new iPhone without having to basically buy a new iPhone because I really want to upgrade. Mine's starting to really slow down and the camera's been so bad for my travels, but it's too expensive and I would very happily switch at this point. I would happily switch to like a Xiaomi or one of the like random Chinese brands of phone. But because I have an Apple Watch, I can't because it won't work with anything else. That's, they've trapped me, which is the plan. I know I fell for it. But New Mobile is this like new company that came out, like NU Mobile came out in Australia. And the whole idea is that it's like refurbished phones, but like really, 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 really good quality. They have these like, you know, crazy engineers testing all this stuff. And you go on these phone contracts that are really cheap. And at any point in time, you can swap or return your phone like for a new one or just to get off the plan or whatever. It's a really interesting business plan. And I've just been intrigued. I'm intrigued because lots of the phone companies have the same exact structure. And so I'm always interested when in any industry, when a new company comes in and like, I don't know, looks at things in a completely different way. And I'm interested to see if this actually disrupts anything or not. And also probably the way I'm going to get a new iPhone when I come home. The second thing I've got in my open tabs, anyone who knows me at all knows that I have an obsession with reading about prison and the justice system and prison reform. And there are a lot of groups that volunteer or do things for prisoners in a really interesting way. And one that I came across, this was an article on the New Yorker, and it was basically, it's all about these kind of photo requests from solitary confinement. And this group who are like a justice reform lobbyist sort of group, they started getting prisoners in solitary confinement to fill out these forms asking like what they would want to see. And then they would get all these volunteers to basically fulfill their requests at these pictures. And it's really, really interesting to see what people kind of miss seeing. Some of them, for example, it's like kids eating in a fast food joint. Some of the cats sitting on a window at dusk is one of the other ones. And there's a website you can go to and you can actually, they've got all the requests there and you can submit photos if you want to kind of help sort of donate these pieces. Anyway, I just thought it was a very, very interesting organization. And the last thing I've got open, well, it's a mixture of about 20 tabs at the moment of like from seek.com.au and pedestrian jobs and various other job sites because I'm coming home soon and I have to figure out the real world, which I mean, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe I'll just run off to the circus. I haven't decided yet.
We will see indeed. Before we close out, it's time for thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, the formidable off of our chest. Lara, what do you have for us? Anything that you'd like to kind of add on to that?
Yeah, I have a thumbs down. course.
Hit me.
I have a thumbs down for going from one country to another where your exchange rate is very different. In Mexico, I was feeling really, really good about the amount of money that I was spending. And one day in New York, and I've spent more than I would in like a week in Mexico on pretty much nothing. Like, I just don't remember buying anything, but all my money is gone. New York is crazy. It's so expensive. And I don't know how people do it. It's just, it really pains me. To be fair, I was complaining about this to my family in Mexico, and they were like, yeah, well, think about how few countries we get to go to where our exchange is better. And I was like, yeah, that's true. All right. My bad. Jeremy, what about you?
I have a thumbs down as well for LinkedIn work anniversaries.
Oh, like, my God.
I love LinkedIn. But
I turned them off. Turn them off, right?
Can you really?
Okay. You can turn those notifications off. Oh, my God. Yeah.
I'm turning my thumbs down around to a thumbs up for turning LinkedIn work anniversary notifications off. An email came in while I was recording saying, you know, that someone congratulated me on one, and it was like, oh no, it's like, this is like the more adult version of getting happy birthdays on Facebook, which still is a thing. I don't know. Anyway,
I'm with you.
Apparently it is my work anniversary. It's somewhere. I don't know. I have like 12 jobs listed on my LinkedIn, so I don't know. Which
oh shit. For. It's actually also mine. No, we missed it. We missed mine. Oops. It was 5 years.
Lara, thanks again. Good luck in New York this week. Stay cool, and we'll talk again next week. I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Lara Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter, and you can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more of the podcast, archives of shows, and everything we talk about in every episode can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And if you want to receive all the links we talk about every week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y. And winter like the season, or email us at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Podcast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, any enhanced podcast player, you'll be able to see visuals for all the links that we talk about, as well as other content as we go on. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye. And so, yeah, she actually explored this on a more scientific level. Scientific. What the fuck am
Please
I saying?
Please don't say scientific.
Scientific, yes. I don't know where that kind of came from.
It was very scientific of you.